This is Talk of the Nation. In Washington, I'm John Idstey, in for Neil Conan. In its idealized version, academia is a hallowed place, a pure center of learning where young minds are shaped and teenagers shed their childhood for the responsibility of future careers. At least, that's the image certain colleges will try to convince you to buy. Others will tell you, or more likely your kids, about their famous professors or great post-graduation job programs or the big screen TVs in the student center. As government funding shrinks and competition for desirable students heats up, colleges and universities are adopting the techniques of the marketplace to survive and succeed. Student admissions officers are now enrollment managers. Focus groups tell schools how to tweak their image to attract alumni donations. And campuses across the country sprout new dorms and student centers with all the perks. But as universities look more and more to the business world to tell them how to run their affairs, is it changing the basic nature and purpose of higher education? What happens when students become customers and academic departments are cost centers? This hour on Talk of the Nation, the marketing of higher education, all the subtle and not so subtle ways schools sell themselves, and what the business model means for academia. Have you gone through college recently or waded through the application process with your kids? What was the sales pitch? And did the product live up to the pitch? If you work in academia, are these changes improvements or distractions? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. With us this hour from the campus of the University of California at Berkeley is David Kirp, a public policy professor there and author of the upcoming book, Shakespeare, Einstein, and the Bottom Line, The Marketing of Higher Education. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, John.
You start the book with the story of a school that took what seems like the ultimate step in marketing. It changed its name. Tell us the story of Beaver College.
Well, Beaver College is an old and estimable liberal arts college. It was a women's college until the 1970s, but as it found itself getting in trouble, not being able to attract students, one of the reasons that marketing consultants kept pointing to was the name, which once upon a time seemed to refer to a harmless animal but had become a double entendre. Mm-hmm. And so Beaver decided it needed to do something about that name, and its enrollment manager pushed it in that direction. It retained a consulting firm. The consulting firm worked with a bunch of focus groups, and voila, it became Arcadia, because everybody thought that meant sort of nice and learning and pastoral, and it became Arcadia U because people thought universities were more serious than colleges.
Is the story of Beaver College unusual? Are there a lot of colleges doing this, changing their names to make their profiles look better?
I think it's an extreme version of the ways in which schools are doing identity makeovers. Lots of corporations do this, and we think nothing of it. But the idea that somehow you can wrap a change in substance and ignore the substance and focus on the image, that seems to me to be a big problem. And that's really what a lot of the stories that we've been hearing about today are about. It's changing image. It's looking for market share. It's talking about mind share. It's focusing on questions that don't have a whole lot to do with those core values of teaching and learning.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the background here. What are the forces that are driving schools to go to these lengths? Is it simply supply-demand, fewer students, more schools, or are there other factors at play?
Well, there's an arms race going on. Schools want to be high on the status ladder, and that status ladder is built to a great extent by the U.S. News and World Report rankings, which are undergraduates' versions of the Michelin Guide. And to succeed in those rankings, you've got, among other things, to be selective in the students that you're pursuing. And so the farther down that ladder you are, the more you're a regional school, the more you don't attract a national audience, the more you've got to go looking out for students, and the more you need students who can pay most or all of the tuition, the more you're going to emphasize aggressively marketing yourself.
But you're saying that it's not that there's a demand or a small supply of students and lots of colleges. It's basically that every college wants the same students, and there's a limited universe of these good students that will make them look good in the rankings.
Yeah, good is a really important word to unpack, because it means people who bring maximum grades and SAT scores, so look good to the U.S. news folks in terms of selectivity, and lots of money. So the kids who are going to get admitted under the criteria good are going to be primarily middle and upper middle class kids. And those that get left out are the kids with the same academic backgrounds but fewer dollars to bring to the table.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the techniques that schools are using to sell themselves to prospective students. Tell us about some of them.
Well, some of the more outrageous focus on the kind of perks that schools create for students. You get sushi bars on campuses. You get personal trainers, movie theaters with surround sound. Washington State boasts that it has the biggest jacuzzi in the West Coast, which is probably saying something. You get ESPN zone quality broadcasting facilities for would-be broadcasters and on and on. You get University of Vermont, an estimable school, deciding it's going to build a new campus center, which includes an artificial skating pond, which, knowing something about Vermont, which probably has more ponds than any place else in the country, does seem to be bringing coals to Newcastle.
And I've noticed,
beyond that,
also a lot of these big student centers are building rock climbing walls. It seems to be especially popular these days.
Well, it's the fad of the moment. And one of the problems that these schools are going to run into is when students decide they don't like rock climbing, they like something else, they're going to be stuck with huge bills. An estimated $12 billion in bond issues this year put out by universities, a lot of it for the kind of these kinds of campus centers and fancy student housing and the like. And that means that schools, many schools, are in the hole to the tune of 10 or 15% of their budgets paying off the interest on these investments before they go anyplace. And so if you build something that's too fancy and they don't come, then you're stuck with that rock climbing wall.
Let's go to bring our callers in on the conversation, our listeners in on the conversation. Let's go to Jim in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jim, you've got a question?
Yeah, actually it's a comment. I'm coming at this from the perspective of a faculty member. And what I've been seeing with higher education being marketed as a consumer product, students look at paying tuition as buying something. And so more and more you're beginning to hear students say, well, I'm paying you to teach me. I'm paying you to give me this education. And they want us to provide them the answers and or give them a degree because they're paying tuition. And there's a little bit of a loss of a work ethic here.
So you don't think students ought to have the attitude that when they pay tuition, they are buying something?
No, I don't think they are.
What are they doing then?
Education's a two-way street. There is no doubt about it. But it's not like you're going into a store to buy a TV, and if you're unhappy with the picture, you take it back. Students need to put in effort to gain their education, as well as the faculty members. And so it's not a passive thing that you're just buying.
David Kirp, would you agree with that?
I think this is a sow the wind, reap the whirlwind story. If you think about higher education as a product that you're marketing, then what you have is consumers who make demands, and the university starts seeing its job as satisfying those demands, as opposed to the old model in which you thought about students as acolytes whose demands were going to get formed during the time that they were in school. And that's a big shift. It affects how much reading you require, the nature of the writing expectation, the kind of courses that are offered, the courses that aren't offered. It's a very short-term student-knows-best strategy, and 18-year-olds know lots of things, but they don't know everything about what a good education would be.
And you think that that's basically what these schools are doing now, just simply treating these kids as students, kids as customers? Is that endemic across the whole nation?
I think you're beginning to see it more and more, and I don't know if you're going to talk about it, but there's a wonderful book that just came out by Derek Bach, who's former president of Harvard, and he wrote a book called Universities in the Marketplace, where he addresses these issues. And I think it's just not students, but the whole idea of higher education is being commercialized.
Thanks very much for calling, Jim.
Sure, no problem.
David Kirp, what do you think? Which students are engaged in this? Is it the elite institutions, or is it small private schools? Is it state universities?
There's competition really up and down the ladder. It's not always competition in the one institution with the other. I want to pick up on that last point because I think it's absolutely right and this is what I try to explore in my book, to suggest that the market ethic isn't just about recruiting students. It's about superstar faculty. It's about the deals that universities make with research institutions. It's about, and at the bottom of the market, it's about what happens to poor kids who don't have the money to go to school, or adjunct faculty who are growing increasingly in number because that's what the universities, having bought those rock climbing walls, can afford to pay.
Mm-hmm. You know, as a parent who sent students to college over the last few years, it occurs to me that one of the problems here is that it's very hard to tell about the real quality of an institution. You know, Harvard gets the top 1% of students, and it turns out the top 1% of students. So what did Harvard do? And you have that with a lot of other so-called elite institutions. Is this simply the sort of the natural way for the marketplace to go if these colleges can't really differentiate on what they add to students? They've got to do it with glitzy things like new student unions?
I think it's really important for colleges to focus on just that question, what it is they can add to students' lives. And the core of that ought to be not rock climbing walls or ballrooms or sushi courts, but something having to do with the quality of instruction, the value added of the education that they're getting. And we're beginning to get ways of measuring that, of focusing that, of addressing that. But at the least, you want a college to say to you, this is what we're about academically. This is what we can offer you. And if I'm a parent and a prospective student visiting a school, I want to spend time in the classrooms. I don't want to spend time looking at the rock climbing wall. Mm-hmm. I want to talk to teachers and see how accessible they're going to be to me.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller, Katie in Charlotte, North Carolina. Katie, you have a question.
Actually, it was a comment that I made.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a recent graduate of Elon University in Elon, North Carolina.
Right.
And we recently changed our name from Elon College to Elon University and underwent massive changes as far as creating a new stadium as well as a TV ESPN zone to attract more males to our campus. And I really feel that all these changes greatly affected my college experience, not necessarily in the classroom, but as far as the outside college experience that I think a lot of kids are going for.
You're saying in a positive way or a negative way?
A positive way, in that I think a lot of kids are going to school not only for an education, but to gain a lot of other things and world experiences. And it definitely made my experience at school a whole lot better.
Mm-hmm. In terms of what you learned or what you could apply in the workplace later, or in terms of your social life?
All of the above. Socially, you know, kids are going to school not only for the academics, but also, you know, to make those business connections for the future and to make those sound relationships and friendships that you'll carry down the road with you. And I think that those programs that are instilled in the universities definitely aid in that experience.
Mm-hmm. David Kirp, what would you say to Katie about her comment?
Well, I think she's right in that one of the good things the market does is that it wakes up dozy institutions and forces them to pay attention to the fact that there's a world out there. And I think she makes another important point, which is a very important reason you go to college is because of your fellow students. This isn't, you know, you don't buy a watch and you think it's worth a lot because nine other people necessarily have the watch, but you go to a school, and if Elon now produces better classmates, you're going to get both a better education and better chances later on in the world. And that's one of the reasons why campuses are fighting so hard in this set of wars about this arms race about mm-hmm. students in order to attract just those kinds of classmates and improve the reputation of the institution.
Katie in Charlotte, North Carolina, thanks very much. David Kirp, stay with us. We're talking about the marketing of higher education. If you've participated in the college selection process recently as a parent or student, what sold you on your school? Were they the right characteristics? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send emails to TOTN@NPR.org. I'm John Itzte. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation in Washington. I'm John Itzty, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about the adoption of marketing techniques in higher education. If you work in academia as a professor or administrator, has the business mentality changed what you do? Is it an improvement or a distraction? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Recently, accounts of the high-priced competition in higher education have been eclipsed by stories of state budget crunches, slashed funding for public universities, and painful tuition hikes. But the building boom continues. With us to talk about the money angle is John Nelson, Managing Director of the Higher Education Team at Moody's Investment Services. He's with us from their offices in New York City. Welcome to the program.
Welcome, John. Thank you very much.
Give us a sense of how much schools are spending right now. Is it a lot more than they did in the past?
Yes, it is, and it's driven by a variety of factors, which you've covered on some of your program. But at the bottom of it all is a demographic upturn in number of high school graduates, which is occurring across the country, coupled with a couple of decades now of fundraising and stock market returns that have really built university endowments to such a level that even with the downturn in the last couple of years, they still have a lot of resources to modernize and expand their programs and campuses.
Mm-hmm. So you'd say this spending is responsible. These colleges have made money, they've got money in their endowments, and they should be spending it on improvements on their campus?
Yeah, I think that there is a lot there is a lot of validity to the perspective that these campuses are a reflection of our changing society, and as research and discovery and education all change and become more complicated and more complex, the universities are responding accordingly. It does drive up the price for some students, but certainly by no means all students.
Mm-hmm. Yes, as I understand it, on the one hand, colleges may be flush in terms of their endowments, but a lot of student activity fees are going up as a result of some of the spending.
Well, John, I think it's important to distinguish between public universities and private universities. Primarily, what's driving the price increase at the public universities is a removal of state subsidies to public universities. And they are now in a very important position in the marketplace where they need to attract more upper-income students or more out-of-state students to pay higher tuitions to replace those lost state dollars.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that out-of-state students pay more, so now the local state university may be more interested in, if it's the University of Maryland, maybe more interested in students from Virginia than Maryland because they pay the price.
Well, that's absolutely the case. There are while it's not true across the board, there are many public universities now that generate the majority of their net tuition dollars from out-of-state students.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a caller in Cleveland. Ted, you're on the air. Do you have a question?
Yeah, a comment and a question. It's been remarked that the society's decline from a perverse intensification of their first principles. American society is a commercial mass entertainment society. So I think what we're seeing in the universities is an intensification of those first principles. The commercialization of the university, the use of inducement of mass entertainment, and we're losing touch with the purpose of the university, which, of course, is education. And I think this is very much aligned with the anti-intellectualism, the militant and aggressive anti-intellectualism of American society. Mm-hmm. So my question is, aren't all of these things, the commercialization of the universities, the going for mass entertainment, sports stadiums and climbing walls, aren't we really losing touch with the fundamental purpose of the university, which is education.
Mm-hmm. David Kerp at the University of California, Berkeley, is still with us. David Kerp, what do you say? Is Ted right?
There are surely powerful pressures pushing in the direction that he describes. And I suppose the thing that gives me heart is that there are some schools that are able to push back. Now, the Harvards can always push back. But there are regional schools that have made their name by being very strong places for an education to get provided for kids who otherwise wouldn't have a place to go. And paradoxically, some of the best education now is being offered by the for-profit schools that say, we really know better than you what's good for you in terms of a mix of liberal education and a technical education. There are some things to be learned from that corner of the market. I'm troubled by the notion that because state contributions have declined, you then go after out-of-state students. Once upon a time, there was a compact between states and their public universities. The state said, we'll subsidize tuitions. The public university said, we'll do a really good job educating our citizens, we'll provide public service, and we'll do important research. Well, that contract is breaking down, and there aren't very many people who are standing up and saying, look, there are a set of principles that need to be reasserted here. There are some important issues that we've got to talk about and not slip into a world in which the public schools and the private schools become exactly indistinguishable from each other. And the losers are those kids who can't pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me just say one more thing here.
Sure.
Very quickly. If you go with the market model and the free market model, which is now a national theology, and you apply it to HMOs, you apply it to Enron, and now you apply it to universities, it has always been a disaster, but it's very hard to break out of that because it is an article of faith in America that the free market should prevail and is always more efficient and more effective than government. And the facts indicate, in many cases, that that is not true. But unfortunately, with the articles of faith, it is very difficult to argue rationality and facts.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Ted.
Sure.
John Nelson, how would you respond to Ted? In some ways, we've just got to admit it, the university and the college system is a marketplace, right?
Well, I think that's absolutely the case. We have an infinite variety of institutions that are operating in very different ways. We like to think of it that there are really four main things that universities offer. In the public's mind, generally, the traditional education instruction in the classroom is all that colleges do, but the reality is they're doing other things, and there are three other things that I think are important. One is career training and job preparation. That would be one. A second would be research and discovery, which primarily occurs not with students, but with faculty and graduate students. And the last and most amorphous, which is really what is driving this investment, is colleges are selling personal growth and opportunity. It is the implicit compact with students and their parents that when they enter their institution at the age 18, they will emerge a different, more mature, more able to adjust student or adult when they're 23. That implies that you're going to have to be in the student residence business. It implies you're going to have to be recruiting students who are very useful and positive influences on the other students. It also ties into the caller's comment on public universities. I think that public universities have also an implicit compact with their state to provide as good quality public higher education as they can. And most students and parents want to be exposed to a diversity of students in every way you define diversity. One of those ways is having more out-of-state students. It's a very common thing for students to choose not to go to their public university because there are no students from other states there, and they want to be prepared for the real world, and that means meeting kids from other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, John Nelson.
Thank you.
John Nelson is the head of the higher education team at Moody's Investment Services. We talked to him from his office in New York City. Still with us in the studios of University of California, Berkeley, is David Kerp, author of the upcoming book Shakespeare, Einstein, and the Bottom Line. Respond to John Nelson's last points there. Would you agree with him?
Well, I think he's got part of the story. What I thought was interesting is the notion that you get educated in part to become a good citizen of the society was missing from the story.
Mm-hmm.
And there really wasn't much attention being paid to the idea that academic life is partly about the pursuit of knowledge, which doesn't necessarily have an immediate short-term payoff.
Mm-hmm.
The market values ideas that it can make money from, but the market doesn't value philosophy or linguistics or pure mathematics because it doesn't see an immediate payoff from those, and it's hard to see how they'll be supported. I just want to say a word about diversity. Maybe students from Maryland are really different from students from Virginia. My hunch is that they're not so very different. And the students that aren't being seen increasingly are students from working-class families. If you look at the gap between college going and college graduation, students in the bottom quarter of the income group and students in the top quarter of the income group, it's astonishing. You get something like 70%, 75% of students in that top group going to four-year schools, only 4% of them not going to college at all. The other end of the spectrum, you get maybe half the students from the poorest families going to any school at all, and almost none of them, 6-7% of them, graduating within 6 years of a four-year BA program.
Let me ask.
So that's what's missing. That's who's missing from the story.
So your view is, if John Nelson says that these colleges are flush now and they're spending money on improvements and that's not a bad thing, you would suggest they ought to spend it on lowering tuition?
Well, some schools are flush. The leading private institutions are flush. The leading public universities, as he also said, are far from flush. And I can tell you that from personal experience here at the Berkeley campus. And I can also tell you that for a school like Berkeley, it's short-sighted, I think, to go after immediate market dollars. It's important for the school to make the claim, and for state schools generally to make the claim, that we really offer an important public service. And there are things that we do that you can't just measure by the market values. If educators have a job of educating, it doesn't stop with 18-year-olds. It has to do with the people who pay the taxes and the people who write the legislation.
Could lowering tuition be a useful marketing strategy, or is there something about a high tuition that signals that this college has really got something special?
Go ahead. It's been done, interestingly. Williams College froze tuition. It can afford to do that. School one step down the road, let's say a Colgate University, looks at Williams and says, God, that's one more source of income that we don't have. I'm glad to see that the University of North Carolina has just adopted the step of saying, we're going to provide scholarship funds for all students who are eligible and admitted to the school. Students work 10 hours a week, but we're not going to make them, find the funds from someplace or other. That's a really bold step for them to take, puts them in the league of Princeton University, which has said basically we're eliminating loans.
Mm-hmm.
And their experience is going to be, I hope, a really important hallmark of what the future could look like that wasn't just a market-driven future. Mm-hmm. In market terms, it gives them an incredible niche because it says we're different. We care about a set of values that other schools don't.
Mm-hmm. Why haven't we seen a Southwest or a JetBlue type college emerge?
Oh, I think we have. They're called Phoenix and DeVry.
Uh-huh.
And they attract increasing numbers of students with a product that is serious both in terms of the technical programs it offers and the liberal arts component of its education. It's a tough, rigorous education. Lots of folks wash out, and almost all of them wind up with decent career kinds of jobs. So that, as I said, there really is something. My colleagues in academia will probably think that I've sort of gone over to the dark side. But there's something to be learned from these schools as well that can be emulated, that it isn't as though DeVry just says, you tell us what you want. DeVry says, we have a sense of what careers are in the fields you want to go into. Trust us.
Mm-hmm.
And that conversation is something that universities can be having with parents and voters and legislators.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. It's hard to think of a state university with more natural selling points than the University of Vermont. The school has a small student body, beautiful mountain surroundings, and the quaint college town of Burlington right outside its gates. So why are they also spending $70 million to build a new student center complete with a movie theater, pub, and artificial skating pond? Joining us now from the studio of Vermont Public Radio in Burlington is UVM's president, Daniel Mark Fogel. Thanks for joining us.
A pleasure to be with you.
University of Vermont seems like the ideal state school. Why do you need to market yourself? Why do you need to build a big student center to attract students?
Well, first of all, it's been fascinating listening to this discussion, and I would say that there's no value that's been articulated by David Kerp or by his faculty caller, Jim, or others that we don't agree with. The life of the mind, teaching and learning, the advancement of knowledge are at the center of what we do at the University of Vermont. We do have unusual advantages as a state university. We have, as David Kerp said, estimable academic quality. But at the same time, we are in a very small state, not a terribly wealthy state. We are already experiencing the market forces that are beginning to crunch other public institutions. That is, we've never had a big appropriation from the state of Vermont. We had none until the mid-1950s, although we were founded over 200 years ago. And we are largely tuition-driven. In order to support students, including low-income students to whom we have commitments, we have to generate tuition largely from non-residents who can afford to pay. Our financial aid is the fastest-growing part of our budget. It went from $35.5 million last year to $42.5 million this year. Our biggest feeder school outside of the state of Vermont is a very diverse high school in the Bronx, full of low-income and very modest-income students. And we are subsidizing them at $10,000 a student from our own budget. Mm-hmm. But the dollars, 80 cents of every one of those $10,000, is paid for by student tuition from students who are attracted to the university. Mm-hmm. Are they amenities? Is there a skating pond? I'm not sure there's a skating pond. Let me skate past that on my rhetorical golden skates and be Hans Brinker for a minute. We didn't put a skating pond into the program for the student union. The architect suggested it as a way of dealing with changing elevations and water runoffs on the site as a nice landscape feature. It may not survive the final design process. Mm-hmm. What we put into the program were spaces where students, faculty, and staff can encounter each other and pursue activities that extend and enhance the experience of the classroom.
Mm-hmm. David Kerp has likened this to an arms race. So if the University of New Hampshire builds a 200-person jacuzzi for students, you don't feel like you have to ante up with something else special to attract students?
No, I don't think we feel that. I mean, there are amenities, and some of them are clearly over-the-top frills. We don't have the big jacuzzis and the humongous climbing walls in our plans. We have lounges. We have places where students can interact informally. We do have what's called a pub bistro in the program. I doubt that it will serve alcohol. It might, I doubt it. I think it will be a place that has the kind of atmosphere that supports poetry readings and open mics and concerts and very high-quality interaction among those peers that you come to college to meet. It's not just a movie theater. It's a student activity theater. There are things that are necessary to create a true community of scholars.
When we come back from the break, China announces a new technique which may someday help infertile women. It's Talk of the Nation. We're talking about the marketing of higher education with Daniel Mark Fogel of the University of Vermont and David Kirp of the University of California at Berkeley. A question for both of you quickly. Is the change in the way colleges are selling themselves driven by changing expectations from students? Is that the real reason, Daniel Mark Fogel?
I think that's part of the reason that there are changing expectations among students, as there are among all people in our society. We live in a different world than our parents were growing up in the 30s and 40s in terms of all sorts of issues around quality of life. But I think a lot of it's a desire by the universities to offer the students the very best kinds of experiences we can in terms of their intellectual and their personal development, and also to tell the story of what we have to offer. After all, to be honest, we are in a very, very competitive higher education marketplace in New England with many of the finest institutions in the country.
Mm-hmm. David, go ahead.
We have to tell our story to students in order to draw them to our campus and reward all of our students with very high-quality peers.
David Kirp, what do you think? Is it driven by expectations of students, or are colleges creating these expectations?
Oh, I think both are true. I mean, we have a generation that grew up with a set of consumer goods that our generation didn't dream of, and they'd like to bring them to college. And if college is meant to be just one more step in that road to life, they respond to those demands. But it's also the case that the competition is much more keenly noticed both by students and by colleges. Now, if the Times story is correct, the folks from Vermont visited 50 campuses to survey the competition before they decided how they would spend their $70 million. And that seems a reasonable thing to do given the market in which they're in. What's depressing about that is that their story is a very important educational story. And it would be a shame to lose that story in the face of having students focus on the wow experience of showing up on campus. And my fear is not enough attention is being paid to the core learning, teaching, genuine community of scholars that we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm. David Kirk, go ahead.
Actually, we visited two campuses. I think what David is picking up on is that the architects we engaged have designed some 50 student unions. We looked at Dartmouth student centers, and we looked at Northeastern's. Mm-hmm. They're natural competitors for us in this region.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Daniel Mark Fogel is the president of the University of Vermont. He joined us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio in Burlington. And David Kirp is the author of the forthcoming book, Shakespeare, Einstein, and the Bottom Line, The Marketing of Higher Education. He's also a professor of public policy at the University of California and Berkeley, and he joined us from their studios on the University of California campus. Thanks very much, both of you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.